my loyal listeners. This is Don in a bit of a odd mood today, so let me start off by saying I apologize for many things, and this is a bit of an odd show of Radio Free Thinker. I know I promised a show about how, the why, and the what to be of the Trump win, but alas, the world, well, it has its own way of doing things. This week I experienced a loss in the family. My Uncle Jack died, and it hit me harder than I thought it would. This loss was preceded by my Aunt Dorothy in 1995, which perhaps due to my age at the time, I may not have felt the gravity of her passing to the extent that, well, she deserved. As time passes, I am becoming more and more cognizant of life and death and the impact on my life and those around me. Now, I may share more with you than, well, you care to know, but confession is good for the psyche, if not for the mythical soul. So why did I cry when I heard my uncle died? Why did it affect my world disproportionately to his actual role in my life? Let me start by revealing I have an atypical family. Well, maybe typical. Who knows? Family is what family is. On the one hand, most of my family, uncle, cousins, aunts, are what you would call estranged. Not for any reason other than, well, it seems that we accept that we are fellow travelers on this earth, but not really much more than that. Again, family is what family is. So in reality, I haven't seen my Uncle Jack for maybe 20, maybe 30 more years. Family comes in different styles, and I have no problem with that. But that led me to ask, why did his death seem so profound, drive me to tears, cause me to take a day of reflection to make this introduction? Well, let's make this more of a teaching moment. And I think this is an example of cognitive dissonance. You see, as estranged as I may be from my extended family, I am extremely close to my immediate family, my parents. I have no brothers and no sisters. I only have my ma and pa, which I often refer to as my M&P. I have, in darker moments, thought about what happened if I died. How would I be devastated by my M&P dying? How their deaths would affect my life? And yet, Jack, this estranged uncle, is in many ways co-equal to my mom. He is, after all, my mother's brother. If I did not care that he died, why should I care that she died? But of course, I would care. I would. I would feel the devastation of grief. And I cannot... I'm going to stop there because there's too much emotion. Even the thought of it is too much right now. So my mind, that massive matter encased within my skull, the logical me, is confronted with this emotional me and wonders, why the difference? And to be fair, there should be no difference. Alas, there is no show this week. Well, a recast at least. Because I lost a member of my family, and although he inhabited an inconsequential part of my life, he still was family. And with all family, the ties that bind are more tenuous than we might know. I'm sorry that we couldn't have been closer in life, Jack. But rest assured, you did mean something to me. And you will be in my memories, and I do mourn your loss. So, as they say in showbiz, the show must go on. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on, and I hope you enjoy this recast of Radio Free Thinker. It's the Juvenoia edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Juvenoia, the creation of teenagers and why we fear the youth. Why we hate cheap things, debunking exoplanets, the fascinating history of robotics and cell phones and cancer. Let's begin episode 315.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
Is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. But cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Dawn, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week, a set of web wisdom clips. Let us start off with a bit from Vsauce about our fears of the next generation, or Juvenilia. Let's listen in.
Hey, Vsauce. Michael here. Skeletons are scary and spooky. But you know what else is? Teenagers. Their attitude, the way they dress, and the music they listen to. Can you even call it music? Kids these days. But what are kids these days? What's with all the concern? And what's a generation? Why do we think that coevals, groups of people of roughly the same age, act so much alike? The sheer number of articles and papers and internet posts published daily comparing then and now, both sincerely and ironically, is astonishing. We can't seem to get enough about kids these days and just how different and awesome it was to be a kid back in the good old days. Generational labels make human history look ordered and discreet instead of scary and messy. They also have a delightfully suspicious tendency to flatter those using them. George Orwell put it well, every generation imagines itself to be more intelligent than the one that went before it and wiser than the one that comes after it. There's a name for this sentiment, Juvenoia. Sociologist David Finkelhor coined the term. It means an exaggerated fear about the things that influence kids these days. Juvenoia is a concerned disappointment that because of iPhones, or the internet, or TV, or rock music, or those pesky horseless carriages, the world just isn't fit for kids like it used to be. Generational conflict really has been going on for that long. After all, honor thy father and thy mother was an ancient commandment for a reason. In the 4th century BC, Aristotle remarked that youth's mistakes are due to excess and vehemence. They think they know everything. Here's an engraving from 1627, admonishing the now compared to the ways of old. In the early 1900s, Romain Rolland complained that the new generation of young people were, quote, passionately in love with pleasure and violent games, easily duped. New people and the direction society is headed in has always been seen with some disapproval. XKCD famously collected a brief history of juicy examples. In 1871, the Sunday magazine published a line that may as well have been written today about texting. Now, we fire off a multitude of rapid and short notes instead of sitting down to have a good talk over a real sheet of paper. And the Journal of Education in 1907 lamented that at a modern family gathering, silent around the fire, each individual has his head buried in his favorite magazine. Point is, there's nothing new under the sun. Not even the sun, in fact. The sun is believed to be a third generation star. This constant cycle of generation clashing can sometimes sound like a broken record. Are these commentaries really providing insight into the minds of future leaders, or prematurely judging a coeval based on how it acts as teens? Despite the incessant concerns otherwise, the proverbial kids these days seem to be better off than ever before. Drug use is down, exercising is up, math and writing proficiency have increased, crimes committed by young people have decreased, hate comments reported by children have dropped, the number of 9th to 12th graders who have been in fights has dropped, and the number of teens who fear attacks at school has dropped. But still, juvenoia persists. But why? Well, it kind of makes sense. I mean, children are the future of a species, so it's reasonable to assume that nature would select for features in a species that cause adult members to prefer the way they were raised and distrust anything different. After all, parents, by definition, were a reproductive success for the species. They made new members. So whatever choices and influences brought them to that point must have been good enough. Any deviation from that could be a problem. So worrying about the young may have been naturally selected, just like eyes and fingers and breathing air and pooping. But here's the thing. Our brains don't accurately remember the past or apply memories fairly or rationally. That kind of thinking has a plethora of interesting causes. First, at a social level, concerns for and about the youth are often exaggerated because exaggerating is effective. You'll generate greater mobilization around a cause if you can convince people that we're on the cusp of a crisis here, folks. Also, our increasingly connected world means more potential contact with people outside the family, the tribe, the neighborhood. Even though juvenile problems often involve people the juvenile already knows, stranger danger is a more powerful fear. My kids have good friends who are good influences, so why should I worry? Can be replaced today with, even so, people you don't know are threats, so worry. Other reasons for juvenoia are personal. Often, it's not so much the world that's changed, it's you. Are drivers today really worse than they were when you were young, or do you simply have new responsibilities and experience that makes you more aware of dangers that were always there? We remember the past abstractly. There just isn't enough room in our brains, or a vital need for complete veracity when recalling things. Thus, we're more likely to remember the general way we felt in the past, without the petty annoyances more salient still for the present. Secondly, loss aversion and the endowment effect. People perceive a loss as greater than an equal gain. In one famous study, when asked how much they would pay for a coffee mug, people gave prices that were significantly lower than what people given the mug first said they'd be willing to sell it for. This may play a role in how we value what we already have, our memories and favorites, over what's new. There's even neuroscience backing up why new stuff seems so bad to you. It's called the reminiscence bump. Storage of autobiographical memories, memories about yourself, increases during times of change. Incidentally, this is why you remember exciting things as lasting longer than they really did, but rarely remember times of boredom in detail. I've discussed before the ways in which this causes us to feel like time slowed down during particularly quick but significant events. Anyway, adolescence and early adulthood, particularly ages 10 to 30, are major times of change. Many important things happen during those years that define your identity. So it's no surprise that, along with things that have happened recently, memories from this bump period are greater in number and more emotional. The books and songs and movies and slang words and behavior you loved and used during this time correlates quite well with what you will, when you're older, remember the most fondly. As we can see, juvenilia is natural. In fact, a healthy dose of it is important. There are plenty of things we should be fired up about improving. What's sometimes lost, though, when explaining that juvenilia occurs in every generation, is the fact that the nature of juvenilia hasn't always been the same. The generation gap of antiquity, or of the 1300s, wasn't the same as it is today. The more rapid speed of change may be one reason, but another is the appearance of a new type of creature around the turn of the last century, the teenager. The word teenager wasn't even used as a stage of life until 1922. John Savage's Teenage is a fantastic read on how human society sort of accidentally invented the teenager. You see, as factories generated new unskilled jobs, young people could acquire something neat, their own money. Suddenly, marketers realized that products could be made for the youth. They were no longer stuck with what their parents decided on. Also, the surge in immigration at the time highlighted for a new generation the view that identity wasn't something you're stuck with. It's fluid, personal, decided. Furthermore, calls for compulsory education around that time, that is, making it the law that children go to school, further solidified the segmented identity of children by forcing them out of the world at large and into common places surrounded mainly by their coevals. In that environment, they could develop behaviors and opinions and culture shared just with themselves. Compulsory schooling also increased literacy in adolescents, which gave them all the more power to hear stories written for them and about them in books they could buy with their own money. Kids these days suddenly weren't just young humans waiting for life experience. They were separate beings with their own culture and voice, a fact that caused juvenilia to change from the Oedipal skirmishes of the past into the full-fledged panics we know and love today. This brings us to a bigger question, though. Sure, you may say, that makes sense, but even someone who didn't grow up in this society could plainly see that in the old days, culture wasn't as dumbed down as it is today. Things used to be made by the elites, for the elites. Now they're made for the masses who demand sensational, atavistic pablum instead of rational, critical thought like scholars and, well, you know, me. Those examples sure are convincing, but the plural of anecdote isn't data. You can pick different examples and argue the opposite point. Mozart wrote poems about farts. There is amazing work, and there is simple work made at all times in history. In fact, as Stephen Johnson points out in Everything Bad is Good for You, if anything, when given the chance to buy or participate as they choose, the tendency we find in humans is a preference for more cognitive demands, for smarter entertainment. What it takes to keep up with the increasing density and intricacies of narratives and media these days is impressive. To be fair, of course, beneath the stimulating organization, there's no substance anymore, right? I mean, here's what one noted critic said of today's easy, brainless mass culture. We do not turn over the pages in search of thought, delicate psychological observation, grace of style, charm of composition, but we enjoy them like children at play, laughing and crying at the images before us. Wait, sorry, that's something literary critic G.H. Lewis wrote about Dickens in 1872. Point is, taste is subjective. Art to one person is garbage to another. You may dislike the language or violence or morals depicted on TV today, but there's no denying the fact that entertainment, including popular entertainment, is requiring more and more thinking on the viewer's part than ever before. Johnson created this visual comparing narrative threads in episodes of different TV shows over time. And this shouldn't be surprising. Our brains crave stimulation. A lump that sits and stares into space isn't naturally selected for in the same way as a brain that learns and synthesizes and organizes. Now that entertainment can be made for niche audiences and watched and rewatched on demand and discussed ad nauseum online, that natural desire can be sated by media. Johnson goes so far as to say that reruns have made us smarter. They've enabled entertainment to be made that rewards being watched and thought about over and over again. The names and stories and relationships and dramas people today have to keep straight in their heads to be functioning consumers of modern media are impressive by historical standards and affect more of us than ever before. Johnson points out that in his time, Dickens was only read by 0.25% of his country's population. While today, innovative shows like The West Wing or The Simpsons easily reach 20 times that proportion. Okay, but how about this? Where are the Mozarts and Dostoyevskys of today? Well, they're probably here, but the reputation of a Dostoyevsky is built by time, something the judgments of contemporary artists haven't had enough of yet. Finally, when it comes to judging works that merely tease the base emotions, let's not forget the quote from Unamuno I've discussed before. More often have I seen a cat reason than laugh or weep. Cats and humans are curious and can problem solve, but only humans can laugh at fart videos. So what really ought we be treasuring? There's a problem here, though. Although writers like Johnson have been able to put forth convincing arguments that movies and TV have been serving more and more cognitive complexity, they've failed to find the same evidence for pop music. Nearly all studies on the subject have found that unlike other forms of popular media, pop music has in fact become, since the 1950s, less complex in its structure and more homogeneous. Mathematically speaking, more pop songs today sound alike than they used to. What's up with that, music? Well, here's the thing. Pop music is just one type of music being made today, and its role, what its listeners want from it, and who they are much more specific than the wider spectrum of genres a movie theater or Netflix caters to. A pop song needs to provoke quick moods, stick in your head, and fit anticipation and payoff into a fairly regular amount of time. There are only so many ways to do that. So perhaps pop music producers have simply gotten better at scratching the specific itch they're challenged to scratch. I mean, imagine criticizing doctors for using penicillin nowadays. Back in the good old days, treatment was innovative. There were leeches and onion plasters, amputation and good luck charms. Now it's all just penicillin, penicillin, penicillin. It's all the same. Criticizing popular music for all sounding the same ignores the sameness of every pop song's goal. But what about generations? What are they exactly? I mean, humans don't have babies all at once every 20 years or so. New people just keep showing up, about four more every second. But that said, there are biological changes humans go through as they grow and age, roughly creating a few life stages. All right, now this list of generations goes all the way back to the mid-1400s. It applies mainly to the Western world, especially the US, and is the work of William Strauss and Neil Howe, whose landmark 1991 book, Generations, contains one of the most influential and ambitious generation theories of our time. These are the guys who coined the term millennial, by the way. They set forth and have continued to expand a theory that society follows a predictable cycle of moods, each lasting about 20 years, about how long it takes for everyone in a life stage to move on to the next. The social mood and the common life stage a coeval experiences it during are what distinguishes one generation from the next. Strauss and Howe call each social mood a turning. A turning describes the way society will act by either establishing, accepting, challenging, or fracturing in lieu of established customs. To illustrate the cycle, let's start just after the American Civil War in the so-called Gilded Age. Here, we find American society in the first turning, what they call a high. This is a 20-year period when society is largely in agreement about the direction it wants to go in, because it recently coalesced in the face of a crisis. Institutions are strong, and thus, young adults are cautious and conformist. But then, people tire of social discipline and call for reform. A period of awakening occurs. The majority consensus is attacked in the name of greater and broader individual autonomy. The distrust in institutions left in the wake of an awakening leads to the next turning, an unraveling, where in place of broad cultural identity, moral crusades polarize society over what should come next. Finally, a renewed interest in consensus that responds to crisis by banding together occurs. Society's mood shifts to a belief that coalescing and building together are the answer. The cycle then starts again with a high. The majority agrees on society's directions and institutions strengthened during the crisis until people tire of this majority structure and an awakening leaves those institutions weak and armed with less public consensus, This is followed by an unraveling where individuals polarize over moral issues, and the youth, raised in the previous two atomizing moods, feel alienated. Which brings us to, well, today. Strauss-Howe's theory, if true, tells us that this will be an era where society will band together and build institutions from the ground up in the face of crisis. It's not clear what that crisis will be, but if their theory has predictive power, the climax of that crisis will occur in 2025. The whole theory is a great way to learn about U.S. history. Al Gore once even gave a copy of Generations to every member of Congress. But it is unscientific and unfalsifiable. You can find a pattern in anything if you pick and choose the right examples. As for the usefulness of its generalizations, well, Philip Bump points out that the U.S. Census Bureau only recognizes one official distinguishable generation, baby boomers. Do you think you are Generation X? A millennial? Generation Z? Well, that's fine, he says. You can call yourself whatever you want. It's all made up. The baby boomers are a cohort, significant in that no matter where they were born or who they are, their size alone determines a lot about their path. But other population segments based solely on birth year just don't mean much. A more useful way to divide them into cohorts might focus on some other less age-related trait that correlates better with behavior, wealth, region, sexuality, etc. Regardless of its accuracy, there's one thing generational theory and its critics do at least agree on. People change as they age, and the larger society surrounding people influences the degree to which generations feel conflict. So, generational thinking is a kind of guidance. It's one that helps take us on a journey, manned by an ever-aging and changing crew. Some crews are different than others, for sure, and you need worry and concern to stay safe. But at the end of the day, it's still the same boat and the same waters. Generations and juvenilia are like what Picasso said about art. They are lies that tell the truth.
Okay, I was kind of afraid of kids before. Now, I don't know, it's maybe. Anyhow, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. We'll return after this break.
Another night's work well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro, and I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pit my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver. Your skeptical break to reality. And we're back. The next clip is from The School of Life and why we value things when they're expensive, but hate them when they're cheap, even though their intrinsic value remains the same. Let's listen in.
We don't think we hate cheap things, but we frequently behave as if we rather do. Consider the pineapple. Columbus was the first European to be delighted by its physical grandeur and vibrant sweetness. He brought some back to Europe, but pineapples proved extremely difficult to transport and very costly to cultivate. For a long time, only royalty could afford to eat them. Russia's Catherine the Great was a huge fan, as was Charles II of England. A single fruit in the 17th century sold for today's equivalent of £5,000. The pineapple was so exciting and so loved that in 1761 the 4th Earl of Dunmore built a temple on his Scottish estate in its honour. And Christopher Wren had no hesitation in topping the South Tower of St Paul's in London with this evidently divine fruit. Then, at the very end of the 19th century, two things changed. Large commercial plantations of pineapples were established in Hawaii, and there were huge advances in steamship technology. Transport costs plummeted and unwittingly transformed the psychology of pineapple eating. Today, you can get a pineapple for around £1.50. It still tastes exactly the same, but now the pineapple is one of the world's least glamorous fruits. It's never served at smart dinner parties, and it would never be carved on top of a major civic building. The pineapple itself hasn't changed, only our attitude to it has. Contemplation of the history of the pineapple suggests a curious overlap between love and economics. When we have to pay a lot for something nice, we appreciate it to the full. Yet, as its price in the market falls, passion has a habit of fading away. Naturally, if the object has no merit to begin with, a high price won't be able to do anything for it. But if it has real virtue and yet a low price, then it's in severe danger of falling into neglect. It's a pattern that we see recurring in a range of areas. For example, with a sight of clouds from above. In 1927, a hitherto unknown airmail pilot called Charles Lindbergh became the first man to complete a solo crossing of the Atlantic in his plane The Spirit of St. Louis. He was awestruck and felt he was becoming, for a time, almost godlike. For most of the 20th century, his experience remained rare and extremely costly. There was therefore never any danger that the human value of crossing an ocean by air would be overlooked. But this lasted only until the arrival of the Boeing 747 and the cheap plane ticket in the summer of 1970. Now, almost no one looks out of the plane window anymore. Why then do we associate cheap prices with a lack of value? Our response seems a hangover from our long pre-industrial past. For most of human history, there truly was a strong correlation between cost and value. The higher the price, the better things tended to be, because there was simply no way both for prices to be low and quality high. Everything had to be made by hand, by expensively trained artisans, with raw materials that were immensely difficult to transport. The expensive sword, jacket, window, or wheelbarrow were simply always the better ones. This relationship between price and value held true in an uninterrupted way until the end of the 18th century, when, thanks to the Industrial Revolution, something extremely unusual happened. Human beings worked out how to make high-quality goods at cheap prices because of technology and new methods of organizing the labor force. However, despite the greatness of these efforts, instead of making wonderful experiences universally available, industrialization has inadvertently produced a different effect. It seemed to rob certain experiences of their loveliness, interest, and worth. It's not, of course, that we refuse to buy inexpensive or cheap things. It's just that getting excited over cheap things has come to seem a little bizarre. One is allowed to get very worked up over the eggs of the sturgeon, £100 for a small pot, but we have to be very circumscribed about one's enthusiasm for the eggs of a chicken, 12 for £2. There is an intimidating hierarchy operating in the background, shaping what we're allowed to be grateful for and feel that we lack and must have. The price tells us something very special is going on here, but it may be going on in the cheaper thing too. How do we reverse this? The answer lies in a slightly unexpected area, the mind of a four-year-old. Here he is with a puddle. It started raining an hour ago. Now the street is full of puddles, and there could be nothing better in the world. The riches of the Indies would be nothing next to the pleasures of being able to see the rippling of the water created by a jump in one's boots. The eddies and whirlpools, the minute waves, the oceans beneath one, it's all fascinating. Children have great advantages. They don't know what they're supposed to like, and they don't understand money. So price is never a guide of value for them. They'll spend an hour with one button. One buys them the £49 wooden toy made by Swedish artisans and finds that they prefer the cardboard box that it came in. They prefer the nail and screw section of a DIY shop to the fanciest toy department. A child might be deeply surprised, even shocked, to learn that a USB stick can be had for just over £1. Children would be right if prices were determined by human worth and value, but they're not. They just reflect what things cost to make. The pity is, therefore, that we do treat them as a guide to what matters, when this isn't what a financial price should ever be used for. We can't directly go back to childhood, but we have got people who can help us in this area. Artists. They are the experts at recording and communicating their enthusiasms, which, like children, can take them in slightly unexpected directions. The French artist Paul Cézanne spent a good deal of the late 19th century painting groups of apples in his studio in Provence. He was thrilled by their texture, shapes and colours. He loved the transitions between the yellowy golds and the deep reds across their skins. Cézanne had all the awe, love and excitement before the apple that aristocrats once had for the pineapple. Cézanne, in his studio, was generating his own revolution, not an industrial revolution that would make once costly objects available to everyone, but a revolution in appreciation, a far deeper process that could get us to notice what we already have to hand. Instead of reducing prices, he was raising levels of appreciation, which is a move that's perhaps more precious to us economically, because it means that we can suddenly get a lot more great things for very little money. We need to rethink our relationship to prices. We've been looking at prices in the wrong way. We've fetishized them as tokens of intrinsic value. We've allowed them to set how much excitement we're allowed to have in given areas. But prices were never meant to be like this. We're breathing too much life into them, and therefore dulling too many of our responses to the inexpensive world. We are, astonishingly, already a good deal richer than we're encouraged to think we are.
On that note, sponsorship to Radio Freethinker just doubled. Do you love us twice as much now? I hope so. We'll be right back after this break.
SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Your local application to skepticism. And we're back. Next clip is from Spacetime, where they debunk the idea that we found habitable planets orbiting other stars. Let's listen in.
Every few months, the press describes some recently discovered exoplanet as the closest thing yet to Earth's twin. But how much like Earth are these planets really? And do we even have the ability yet to answer that question? Lots of headlines have touted the discovery of potentially habitable worlds, some of which might be Earth twins. Now, typically, these stories are accompanied by pictures that look a lot like M-class planets from Star Trek, with a solid surface, liquid water, and a surface gravity that humans could at least function in. But unfortunately, those are all artist renditions. These exoplanets don't actually look like that. Or maybe they do. No one knows. In fact, we have no idea whether any of these planets has water or oxygen, let alone whether you could just walk out of a spaceship and hang out there. It's not that the press or astronomers are lying. There's just a major disconnect between what many people imagine when they hear the phrase habitable world and what astronomers mean by that same phrase. To astronomers, the phrase habitable exoplanet just means exoplanet that lies in the habitable zone of its host star. And the habitable zone, in turn, is defined as the sweet spot of orbital distances from that star at which the energy from starlight would produce the right temperature on a planet's surface for water to remain liquid, provided the planet actually has a surface and provided there's enough atmospheric pressure. Now, the bad news is that being in the habitable zone isn't even remotely close to a guarantee of actual human habitability. For instance, Venus has a solid surface, and it has plenty of atmospheric pressure. Plus, if you expand its orbit just a teensy bit, it would be in the sun's habitable zone. But there's no liquid water there. So is the habitable zone instead a prerequisite for habitability? Not exactly. A planet with a super thick atmosphere, for example, could have surface water in a larger orbit than you'd ordinarily expect. Basically, the habitable zone is more of a guideline, a starting point to narrow down targets of interest. Those estimates you hear of an average of one habitable planet per star in the Milky Way are really just statements about this starting point. But to make a more definitive assessment of habitability, actual habitability, for any of these exoplanets, you have to analyze their atmospheres. And here's the thing. We don't know anything about the atmospheres of any of the so-called Earth-like habitable worlds that get reported in the press. In fact, we can't be certain that they even have atmospheres at all. Take Kepler-186f as an example. In April 2014, this planet got a lot of press as the first confirmed Earth-sized exoplanet in the habitable zone of its host star. These artist renditions make it look pretty sweet. But the only sense in which we've actually seen Kepler-186f is this graph. It shows the microscopic dip in starlight measured by the Kepler telescope when the planet moved in front of its star. By knowing some properties of that star, then based on how much light gets blocked and for how long, astronomers were able to infer the radius of the planet and some features of its orbit, like its approximate distance from that star. Turns out Kepler-186f is about 10% larger in radius than Earth in an orbit around the size of Mercury around a fairly dim red dwarf star. So basically, it's a planet like Krypton. Or maybe it's nothing like Krypton, because at 500 light years from Earth, Kepler-186f is just too far away to determine its mass or anything about its atmosphere with current or planned telescopes. All we know are its radius and the approximate size of its orbit. That's it. Sure, you can put limits on its mass by considering extremes of what it could be made out of, and it seems likely from those bounds that it has a solid surface. But the atmosphere is, wait for it, totally up in the air. It could be Earth-like, or it could be wispy and barely there like on Mars, or a carbon dioxide super greenhouse like on Venus, or it could have no atmosphere at all. We just don't know. Okay, what about habitable zone exoplanets that are closer to us than Kepler-186f is? Could we measure properties of their atmospheres and locate a truly habitable world like that? Well, here's where it gets interesting. You can measure the atmosphere of an exoplanet, but not if that exoplanet is an Earth-sized rocky body in a star's habitable zone. Let me explain the problem. To analyze a planet's atmosphere, you need to isolate the planet's light from that of its star and see how bright that light is at different wavelengths. That graph of brightness versus wavelength is called an object spectrum. Since different atoms and molecules emit or absorb particular wavelengths of light only, the spectrum tells you a lot about atmospheric composition. If you combine that information with a planet's mass, radius, and distance from its star, you can use models to get a rough picture of what the atmosphere is like. Okay, so how do you isolate a planet's light? There are two basic methods. First, you can directly image the planet, improving the contrast by blocking out the star's light, kind of like putting your hand over your eyes on a sunny day to help see your surroundings. But this only works for planets that are in very large orbits outside the habitable zone, because closer in, the contrast is still too low. The planet just gets washed out by the star's light. Remember, planets don't glow very bright on their own. The second method takes advantage of what are called planetary transits. You take a spectrum of the star when the planet is in front of it. This will be the combined spectrum of the planet and star. And then you take another spectrum when the planet is behind the star. That gives you the spectrum of the star alone. Subtract the two, and you get the spectrum of just the planet. It's very clever, but unfortunately, this method only works for planets that are really close to their stars, because only planets that are close in will get hot enough to glow enough to improve the contrast ratio for that method. So you see the problem. To be in the habitable zone, a planet has to be small enough to be rocky like Earth instead of gaseous like Jupiter, and it can't be either too close or too far from its star, or it won't have liquid water. But unless it is really close or really far, its atmosphere cannot be measured easily, and you can't know whether it really might be habitable. It's a catch-22, but only because of the limitations of current instruments. There was a proposal for a Terrestrial Planet Finder, or TPF, a space telescope that could have analyzed the atmospheres of Earth-sized planets in Earth-like orbits around sun-like stars. But funding for the TPF was cut a few years ago, so for the foreseeable future, pinning down the actual habitability of true Earth analogs isn't happening. So does that mean identifying the only potentially habitable worlds is a waste of time? No. On the contrary, it's critical. We have to narrow the field, and we need to improve our census of what kinds of exoplanets are out there. It's important science. I just think it's also important to understand that despite what you read, we don't actually have the means to identify Earth 2.0 yet. But we could. The science is pretty much all there. And ironically, if headlines didn't make people think we'd already identified Earth 2.0, there might be more public outcry to make these missions happen. I don't see hashtag IWantEarth 2.0 on Twitter yet. So what do you guys think? I know the exoplanet people need to pump up public interest in their work, and the press always needs good stories, but could the current way of reporting about habitable exoplanets be shooting the actual identification of Earth's twin in the foot? Discuss in the comments, and we'll see what you guys have to say on the next episode of Space Time. Last week, we talked about E equals MC squared and issued a challenge question to all of you. If everyone on Earth picked up a hammer at the same time, by how much would Earth's mass increase due to the excess gravitational potential energy? The answer? It wouldn't. Earth's mass would stay exactly the same. Sure, there's more gravitational potential energy in the hammers, but that was previously stored as chemical energy in the ATP in your muscles, and thus was already being weighed as part of the mass of the Earth. It's true, if aliens came along with some spaceships and lowered down some cranes and lifted the hammers for you and put them in your hands and then left, then yes, energy would have been injected into the system and Earth's mass would negligibly increase. But the way I pose the question, the answer is no change. We got hundreds of responses, many of which were correct. But the first five that came in on or after our earliest submission time were Charles Eubanks, who actually got the answer from his wife, Carolee, Lucas Poli, Jonas Kreidelmeier, Mihai Cagnaro, and Fabio Reale. Great work. Some of you submitted emails with the wrong subject line. For future challenges, please make sure your subject lines match what we say exactly. We are filtering these emails automatically and we don't want to lose your submission. Now to your comments and questions. You guys actually submitted a lot of really thoughtful ones. I can't get to all of them here in the video, but I am trying to answer as many as I can in the comments section. Please browse that section, and in particular my responses, because many of your questions may be addressed there. Johansson from It's Okay to Be Smart asked, if my mirrored box had a tiny hole in it so some light could escape, would its mass go down? Answer, yes. Energy's escaping, you're not weighing it anymore. And Joe, that question is all right, but you need to up your question game a little bit. This is PBS Spacetime, and we have standards. Dan Cattell asked whether the human body really does lose a little bit of mass when it dies. I mean, it does, but not for any deep reason. There's some matter exchange just because the human body is porous, and from an E equals MC squared perspective, your drop in body temperature alone would mean there's less thermal energy contributing to the total mass. It's like parts per billion billion, but technically, yes. Tim Chappelle asked how both fusion and fission could end up releasing energy. Why is that so surprising? If there's a configuration in which something has less total potential energy than it did before, then that configuration will have less mass, and the excess potential energy would have to have been released in some form. Sometimes you have less total potential energy by putting things together. Sometimes there's less potential and kinetic energy if you pull things apart. It's not splitting or putting things together that makes the difference, it's just the total energy budget that determines whether something will release or not release energy. Natalia B, Pablo Herrero, and Goro Rojo all asked whether photons actually have mass if they have energy. The answer is no, and I gave a pretty detailed explanation of why in my response in the comments to Goro Rojo's question. Check that out. Also, check out an excellent video by Minute Physics titled What is Mass, and I think it'll give you some clarity about the question. Gareth Dean asked, if all the photons in the universe have been redshifting as the universe expands, that means they're losing energy. Where did all that energy go? That's a really subtle question. You can loosely think of that energy as going into the expansion, but even that's not quite correct. The bottom line answer is that in general relativity, there actually is no such thing as energy conservation for the universe as a whole. How that can be, even though locally in local pockets you can have energy conservation, seems weird and contradictory, but general relativity is quirky like that. It's a little too much to go into right now, but maybe we'll tackle it in a future episode. Finally, consider this points out that despite what I said in the episode, in the SI system of units, amount of stuff, the SI unit of the mole, and mass, the SI kilogram, are defined in terms of one another, so they really are correlated. Except physically, that's not true, and proposals are on the table to modify the definition of the SI kilogram in terms of fundamental constants of nature, like Planck's constant and the speed of light. If that happened, then effectively the kilogram would be redefined as the total amount of effective mass you'd have from putting some number of photons in a mirrored box, more or less. They're ironing out the details, but it is highly likely that at some time in the future, the SI unit will reflect the physics that I articulated in this episode, namely that mass and amount of stuff are independent things.
Don't despair, my loyal listeners. There is life out there. As the X-Files put it, I want to believe. And in this case, I'll give you a skeptical pass. We'll return after this break.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway.
Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker and CITR 101.9 FM, your dose of reality in a world of woo. And we're back. The next clip is from SciShow, where we learn about the history of robotics. Let's listen in.
You'd think the robot revolution would have happened by now, with the self-aware robots taking over the world, becoming our overlords, making us work in the tungsten mines. Well, the thing is, the robot revolution already is happening. It's been happening for decades. It's just been a lot less bloody than the movies made us think it would be. And the robots are not self-aware. Yet. But in all likelihood, your car was made by a robot. These days, there are robots helping spacecraft dock at the International Space Station, and you might even have one faithfully vacuuming your kitchen floor. Not exactly Skynet, but all of the convenience that we already enjoy thanks to robots took decades of hard work by scientists, and some of the problems that robotics engineers were struggling with 50 years ago still haven't been solved. So there's a whole lot of history that went into the robots that we rely on today, and it just might help you understand why we don't have robots taking care of our every need, or forcing us to mine their tungsten. If we're going to talk about the history of robotics, first we need to talk about what a robot actually is. And for such a common term, it's surprisingly slippery to define. But technically speaking, a robot is just a machine designed to accomplish a task. That's it. Now, it might sound like that would cover everything from a four-function calculator to NASA's Pleiades supercomputer, but that is not what we're talking about here. When we talk about robots, we're really talking about machines that use their programming to make decisions. For example, if you, a human, decide to pick up a coin from the ground, there are three main steps you have to go through. First, your eyes need to see the coin and then send that information to your brain. Then your brain processes that input and uses things like previous experience to make a decision to pick it up. Eventually, your brain sends messages to your body to grasp the coin. Robots go through a similar process, but without getting the Slim Jim at the gas station. They can go through that process because most of the time they have the components that let them carry out each step. They have sensors for input, control systems for decision making, and end effectors for output. Sounds simple enough, but developing each of these components can be challenging. Sensors have to be able to detect things like images and sound accurately. Effectors have to be flexible and fast enough to do what we need them to do. And the control system has to make all of the decisions necessary to get the sensors and effectors working together. Of course, there are so many different kinds of robots that these components can vary considerably, but that's the basics of robot anatomy. Now, if we tried to talk about every advance that's been made in every subfield of robotics in just the past half century, we'd be here all day. But to understand how we've gotten this far and why robots haven't taken over the world yet, we first have to talk about how the development of industrial, humanoid, and military robots got the field where it is today. Industry is a good place to start because that's where robots first became useful. Since factory work can be repetitive and often involves lifting lots of heavy stuff, it's the perfect fit for a machine. The world's first ever industrial robot, Unimate, was installed on a General Motors production line in New Jersey in 1961. Weighing in at nearly a metric ton, it was basically a giant robot arm. Its instructions, programmed on a huge magnetic drum, told the arm to stack and weld hot pieces of metal over and over again. Soon, other car companies got in on the game, installing their own robotic arms. But this first generation of robots was still in its awkward stage. The arms weren't particularly flexible. They were often powered by clunky hydraulics, and they were ultimately difficult to program. So when a robotic arm called IRB-6 came along in 1974, it was a pretty big deal. This was the first electric industrial robot that was controlled by a microcomputer. It had 16 kilobytes of RAM, it was programmable, and it could display four whole digits with its LEDs. Developed by Swedish engineering firm ABB, this robot was used to perform inauspicious tasks like polishing steel tubes, but it was a crucial step toward developing robots that were easier to program. But while controlling robotic arms was getting simpler, another issue came up. You can give a robot as much programming as you want, but if it can't see, it's not going to be able to do even seemingly simple things like figure out which box should go where on a pallet. Crude visual scanners had been around since the 50s. They could only see black and white, and the resolution was worse than what you get from a flip phone camera. But to give vision to industrial robots, engineers had to tap into another field that would completely change the robotics game, artificial intelligence. Now, artificial intelligence, or AI, is another broad, vague term used to describe any attempt to make a computer do something that we'd normally associate with human intelligence, like translate languages, or play chess, or recognize objects. In the 60s, the problem was that even though AIs were getting better at complex reasoning tasks, like playing chess and proving mathematical theorems, it was incredibly difficult to actually get the programs to interact with the real world. There's a difference, for example, between figuring out the ideal placement of a wooden blocks in a theoretical model and actually moving those blocks into place. Because moving them involves a whole series of discrete decisions and actions, and the robots of the time simply couldn't manage that. For robots, vision isn't just about taking pictures. It's also about recognizing objects so that they can react to things and situations in real time. By the late 1970s, engineers had developed new algorithms that allowed cameras to recognize edges and shapes by using visual cues like highlights and shadows, but these programs were still just experimental, stuck in research labs. That all changed in 1981 when the first industrial robot got the gift of vision. A General Motors factory was once again the guinea pig, implementing a system called ConSight, in which three separate robots could use visual sensors to pick out and sort six different kinds of auto parts as 1,400 parts per hour moved by on a conveyor belt. Progress! For the next two decades, technology kept improving. Industrial robots were able to see better, move faster, carry heavier loads, and handle more decisions. These days, industrial robots are advanced enough that it's totally normal for a factory to install a robotic assembly line that handles nearly all of its production. And some industrial robots are heading in the direction of a more general-purpose use, like Baxter, the humanoid industrial robot. Humanoid, yet again, a very subjective term, but it just means human-like. For robots, that usually implies that they're designed to look and act as human-like as possible. So Baxter, for instance, is nearly 2 meters tall, weighs 136 kilograms, and has a screen for a face. It also has a vaguely human-shaped torso and two arms. But more importantly, it can be quickly programmed to do practically anything. If a factory worker or researcher has a task to do, Baxter can probably handle it as long as it's lifting less than 2.2 kilograms because its arms are not industrial strength. But it does need to be told what to do. If you want Baxter to stack some products in a box, for instance, you've got to program it by manually making it do what you want the first time, and then it'll imitate that task. And its shape may be loosely based on a human, but Baxter cannot walk or climb stairs or talk. So getting a robot to act like a human has proved to be a whole other ballgame, and it's one that researchers have been working on for decades. And it's been slow going. The Wobot 1 is usually considered to be the first full-scale humanoid robot. Developed by researchers at Waseda University in Japan in 1973, it had arms, legs, and a vision system. It could walk, it could pick things up with its hands, could even talk. Except that it could only reply with pre-recorded responses to very specific statements, and it took 45 seconds to take one step. This bot and its successor, Wobot 2, were a really big deal in their day, but they also pointed out an important fact. It's just much easier to design robots to do one task at a time. So recently the thinking has been, if general-purpose humanoid robotics are out of our grasp, we might as well focus on making something that can do at least one useful task. That's why in the past 10 years there have been more household robots in use than ever, programmed to perform a single function, like vacuuming the floor, mowing the lawn, washing windows, or cleaning the pool. They're not quite rosy from the Jetsons, but they were all made possible by the advances that came before them, like having the ability to sense their surroundings and make decisions in order to navigate the world. And it's not like researchers have given up on the humanoid front. There are humanoid robots in development that can perform some impressive feats. Honda's Asimo, for example, can walk at speeds of almost 6 kilometers an hour, climb up and down stairs, carry a tray, push a cart, among other things. So again, progress. You just can't buy one. For the time being, Asimo is basically a research tool.